Thank you for standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, and we now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead.
Good morning to everyone, and thank you very, very much for joining us today to Capital Link's webinar series. I am Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, and today's roundtable discussion will focus on the product tanker sector, the sector trends, the outlook, and we have with us three CEOs who are our panelists. We have Kim Ullman, the CEO of Concordia Maritime, listed in Stockholm. We have Marco Fiori, the CEO of D'Amico International Shipping, listed in Milan, and Robert Bugbee, the President and Director of Scorpio Tankers, listed in New York. And the moderator for today's panel discussion is Spiro Dounis, the Research Director and Shipping Analyst from UBS. The event, as you know, is accessible through a live audio webcast, and then it will also be available as an audio archive, accessible upon demand anytime you would like, through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. We are going to start our panel with a short presentation from Spiro, who is going to set up the stage for what is happening in the sector, and then we are going to proceed with the moderated discussion. Spiro will be asking our panelists a number of questions. Please note that on your screen, the presentation slides are user-controlled. That means that clicking on the button that says next slide or previous slide, you can move backwards or forwards on your own. And after the panel discussion, there will be a Q&A session with questions coming from the audience. Webinar participants can submit questions to the special button on the event page that is titled Ask a Question, or you can email your questions to us at questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. You can submit any question at any time during the event, and these questions go to Spiro, who is going further to ask them to the panelists. And we already have a few questions that I can see. Please send us more. By the way, the questions and opinions expressed by the presenters are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the panel discussion webcast may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. As you know, Capital Link has made a strategic commitment to the shipping, to the maritime sector, and in addition to annual conferences and weekly shipping newsletter, we hold industry webinars on a regular basis, not only on maritime, but also on other topics, closed-end funds, ETFs, and so on. And we have a library with great content that you can access anytime at www. And you heard enough from me. I would like to thank all of our panelists, Kim, Marco, and Robert, and of course, Spiro, for being with us today. And Spiro, the floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Nicolas, and good morning, everybody. So as Nicolas mentioned, just a really quick overview of the product tanker space. You should have the slides in front of you. So if everyone just clicks to slide number one, we're going to start here with the order book. And clearly you can see order book is well off the highs that it was during the last go-around. And even off of recent highs, it's come down from 20% to closer to 16% of the fleet. And for the first time in a while, it's actually lower than the order book in the crude tanker space. So that's a lot of positive development there. And on the negative side, obviously, that it's lower because a lot of vessels have been delivered. And as we look forward to next year, you can actually see in the delivery schedule on the graph below, actually looking for a pretty big delivery year in 2016 and a little bit more in 2017. So hopefully our panelists can maybe address any concerns they have about the risk of oversupply going forward, but the order book has come down recently, so that's been positive. Moving to the next slide, slide two, you can actually see rates have come well off the bottom, not quite back to prior cycle highs, but what you can see is a recent dip actually just in the last few weeks, and so some people are starting to question, is it seasonal, is it structural? Once again, hopefully the panelists can shed some light on that, but there has been a big step down recently. If you look to the bottom right graph, product tanker charter rates have actually just been consistently higher. And so that's been a really positive development. They seem to continue to go up. But of course, this is a much, you know, shallower market, lacks the depth of the spot market. And so hard to say if that's truly representative of the health of product tanker rates. Moving to slide number three, we can actually see here the vessel values for new builds have been flat to maybe slightly trending down. Those are the solid lines. Now, we believe that's probably for two reasons. One is currency fluctuation, just given the stronger dollar. The second reason is yard capacity has opened up and has likely led to maybe a price war to drive prices down to fill up those slots. What you look for the health of the market as it stands right now on real market terms is the secondhand vessel market. And when you look at the dotted lines there, that's actually the secondhand. That's a five-year-old vessel price. And so that's actually been generally trending up. And for the most part, the larger vessels have been leading that charge up. We believe because of the changing trade pattern towards longer haul voyages is essentially what's bidding that up. So we'll see how long that can last, and hopefully the panelists have a view on that. Just wrapping it up here, the product tanker thesis, you know, I'm sure we've all heard this before. Ton-mile growth as a result of refinery closures in Europe. They're much older capacity. They're not, you know, they're making money now thanks to the oil price, but for years have been sort of struggling. And we've got a lot of new capacity coming on in the Middle East and Asia that's expected to displace that refining capacity. That leads to ton-mile growth from the Pacific Basin to the Atlantic Basin. We're looking for product demand to increase by about 6.3 million barrels a day by 2019. And the seaborne trade is actually expected to increase its share of that total demand, just given the global imbalances and geographical arbitrage we expect to increase going forward. What's the biggest risk? In our view, we see significant vessel deliveries next year, as we mentioned before. More ordering potentially could also put some pressure on rates. But of course, it's hard to predict what the ordering pattern is going to look like. So with that, I will we'll turn over to the panelists now and maybe to begin the discussion. And Kim, just kind of want to start with you and Marco and Robert can ask you to chime in on this one. But Kim, you recently said that you hoped that no more orders would be placed because you thought the supply-demand balance was beginning to look a bit tight. So I guess I'm just wondering how tight, you know, do you really think it is? Is it something that's really keeping you up? And Robert and Marco, you both recently placed new building orders, MRs and LRs. Just wondering, are you not as worried about this as Kim and maybe why you placed those specific orders? Kim, please go ahead.
Sure. I'm Kim Ullman. Thanks for inviting me for this. I'm starting to get a little concerned. Of course, the expression that I was quoted saying no more orders is a bit of an utopia, of course, because we will need replacement and there will be orders placed against TCEs and systems and contracts of affreightment and what have you. But what I was referring to is that speculative, excessive ordering. In general, because that could really tip things over. So why I think that is because I think the markets are fundamentally in balance finally balanced, so to speak, where you have on the product side in 2015, 2016, a supply growth, net supply growth of ships with 6-7%, and demand is looking kind of 5-6%. I know that's just the very basic fundamentals. And thanks to a crude oil market that's been pretty good, thanks to, again, the fact that they haven't had too many ships coming in, increasing the supply. The figures I was mentioning before was for the product tanker side. And because of the high crude market, ships have swung over to the dirty side, and that has certainly helped the product tanker market space. So my bottom line is, yes, there is a certain concern. We have markets in balance right now, generally speaking, and the two sectors, crude and products, are helping each other. We've started to see some, you know, crude orders coming in on VLCCs and Suezmax tankers, and in its extension, it will have an effect on the product tanker market as well. So any excessive ordering now on the product side could help disrupt and tip things in the wrong way again, so to speak.
Got it. Robert, you just placed some new orders not that long ago. You've got some options too. Are you not worried about oversupply?
Not at the moment, no. I think that we didn't place many orders. I think that it's the yard capacity isn't that high at the moment for availability of really good quality vessels out of Korea. I mean, some of the orders that you could see our own announcements that we could, even when we were ordering back 2 months ago, we were getting deliveries just a couple of ships in first quarter 17. So, this is not a 16, this is a 17. And when we look forward into 17, 18, 19, we think that you'll finally get to that point where a lot of the fleet will start to approach 15 years old. And 15 years old, we consider a critical age for a product tanker. We haven't had any sort of real commercial attrition because the product tanker fleet has just been really net additions for the last 10, 15 years. But as we get into those vessels that were delivered in the bulk of the vessels delivered in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, we will get some attrition from the the higher paying markets, which will not quite be the same as scrapping, but will still be it will still have the effect of keeping the supply side under control. And the second side is that we still see, I think it's fairly late now, there isn't any speculative money out there for orders. The equity markets are pretty closed for a speculative order position. A lot of our competitors are really trying to securitize what they have or are unable to order at the moment. So we think that in 17, 17 will have an order book that's much less than 16. And we have a demand side that is, it's pretty healthy at the moment. I mean, we're sitting here in October, and I can't remember many times in realized earnings because of the triangulation and the fact that demand is so strong and diverse across the world, where real earnings, not what you're necessarily seeing on one voyage, et cetera, are as high as they are at this time of year whilst we're still going through the refinery turnarounds. So we're seeing a demand side that has been accelerating, and you can't add to 16 and 17. It's not that easy to add to what is already a continuing declining order book.
Marco, do you agree with Robert? And maybe if you could just give us some color on why you chose LR1s as opposed to increasing your MR stake or maybe LR2s.
Well, I agree with what Robert was saying. We are constantly on the market also for looking for long-term charter deals from tonnage providers such as the Japanese. And today, you can't find any kind of deliveries out of Japanese yards for chartering that's going to be delivered before 2018. So they're starting to talk about 18, 19. So I think 16, 17 are kind of full. As a matter of fact, the last two LRs that we have ordered are for delivery 2018. So for sure, I think that the numbers we have are pretty much the numbers are going to be, there's not much additional capacity to be added to that. On the fact of the LRs, we started the beginning of the year ordering two of them, then went for another two and then another two. We have kind of, first of all, it's a natural extension of our fleet in the LR space. We have Handys, MRs, now we're extending to LRs. The clients that we have in the Handy and MR space are the same ones that would be there in the LR space. And furthermore, as you said before, the fact that there's going to be a displacement of the refiners, we see some longer voyages where therefore you can maximize bigger ships on these kind of longer voyages.
Right. So, Robert, you mentioned tanker rates this time of year and refinery turnarounds. So, you know, I guess rates over the last few weeks for product tankers have been pretty challenged, and before that it was crude tankers, which bounced back pretty nicely. So, you know, I guess part of the reason, like you mentioned, is refinery. Is there anything else you can attribute the weakness to, and when do you believe it's going to reverse?
But that's the whole point. I don't call this weakness. I consider this strength. You have to look at this on its seasonal basis. At this time of year, in most years, your real earnings are on their knees. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a you know, well-run modern fleet pools in the general market would have had earnings close to $20,000 a day in this period of this last 4 weeks in terms of realized earnings, because of the ability to triangulate and some of the routes that you don't see. We have ships that are on voyages carrying jet fuel from Korea to Florida. We have voyages and gasoline reformates from the U.S. Gulf to China. These routes are not on any of your published indexes. So you have a market that is so diverse and so globally strong that at a time of year that normally is a collapse, if you're even approaching 20,000 in a pool now, compare that in first quarter 2000 this year, which is first quarter is meant to be a strong quarter, Sting itself reported $20,500 a day for the quarter. So if we are going into this winter, this strongest season, off the strongest base that we have had in terms of tightness of supply and demand, the markets are actually functioning. And, you know, winter will come, the refineries will finish their turnarounds. And one other thing I would add to your supply list is that your supply graph, as is everybody's, are static. What we have learned this year, and anybody, any of us with new buildings being delivered, these vessels are coming later this year than we originally expected because the yards have slowed down their workbooks. So the chances are that what you see in your data set is the absolute maximum of what can be delivered next year. And it's unlikely that it will reach that number because I'm fairly sure that ships that should be delivered in 16 will be delayed to 17.
Fair point. Marco and Kim. Sorry. Go ahead. No, please finish.
I just said I don't consider this as weak in its seasonal basis. I mean, it's, you know, if you had ice cream sellers selling ice cream in Central Park right now, you would consider that strong, even if they were selling less ice cream than they were in July.
True. That's fair. And I mean, I agree to the extent it's seasonal, then this is strong. If it's structural, which it doesn't sound like it is, that's a different story. But Marco and Kim, do you sort of agree with that sentiment? And when are you handicapping or trying to figure out when rates finally turn around and sort of come back up towards 3Q levels?
You know, I think that we're coming out also of a Q3 that historically has been one. Q3 historically is a weak quarter, and we had one of the strongest quarter of the year in Q3. So I think that had a lot to do because refiners have been continuing to delay their process of re-overhaul, and now all of a sudden we've kind of delayed all this process. So I wouldn't be surprised that this is a lull in the market that should be quite quickly overcome. I wanted also to go back to the first questions about the tonnage. I think that a lot of the tonnage has been a kind of a push to building ships in this year and to order ships this year because there's a lot of new regulations that are changing. So there was a kind of a rush to the finish line, and a lot of people have been placing orders now, and I think for a while we won't see orders because applying new regulations, ships are going to be more expensive. So I think the ships that have been ordered now are going to be the last of the cheaper ships to be available in the market.
Yeah. Kim, anything else to add?
Well, I guess pretty much the same. Agree. Q3 has been good. Started off fantastically. It's been winding off since then. Of course, October has been 3 million barrels a day less in refining. processing, and that is expected to come back towards the end of the year. So I think even if Q3 has surprised us, the start of Q4 is you know, a little bit mediocre to start with. But I agree with the sentiment, and that's and I totally agree with this, and not spoiling the party. It's and I've been saying it at each whatever seminar there's been that we will have seasonality in high markets as well, but they will not be as low, they will not be as long as they've been before, and I think Q3 is about to prove that. So from that point of view, I totally agree that it's low, but it's not at all close to as low as it has been the last couple of years.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so let's switch it up and move to floating storage, which, you know, is something you hear a lot about in the crude tanker space, and not as much about product tankers. And I guess what we're kind of hearing is there's a lot of diesel and jet fuel sitting off the coast of either Europe or Asia. We're hearing about VLCCs actually moving diesel fuel from Asia over towards Africa, and sort of the shadow storage that's taking place. And a lot of that, we suppose, has to do with the fact that we keep hearing that middle distillates are in massive oversupply globally. Just wondering how you believe that's going to impact product tankers and product tanker rates. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And you know, are you seeing that? Robert, we'll start with you.
Well, I think we're talking here, if we look at it in terms of supply first. So one other issue very quickly is that the market has had to absorb a speeding up of the general fleet. The general fleet in products in this year is higher than it was in the year before, which is also adding to supply. So that, a simple thing of ships delivering against demand, is understating the real demand growth. So that's an important point to see. We can't speed up our ships anymore, so that part of the slacking is gone. Amongst our pools, we have about 160, you know, product tankers in the market at the moment on the water, and not a single one of them is on storage. Not one. And, you know, we'd be really happy to have ships on storage being paid a load of money and not. Storage is okay. So, you know, yes, you're reading VLCC trades that were done months ago and, you know, different points, but it's not like we have a whole bunch of product being stored around the world at the moment. And I think that's pretty exciting, because that's still to come.
Interesting. Marco, you kind of agree with that sentiment, and do you have any ships that have been sort of taken out of storage either intentionally or just maybe are sitting outside of a port for the last 60 days?
No, actually we haven't, but, you know, then you should not forget we have smaller size ships, so that would be not be used for storage. However, I think that also Robert is right. You know, one thing is storing crude oil. You know, it's one product. You have VLs, you have Suezmaxes, you can store it in. Products, which products are you going to store? You know, then you start getting, it's a lot of products that are getting churned out of refineries. So, you know, you have also to decide which one is going to be stored, which one is not. So, you know, I think it's the storing of clean products is a completely different game than crude. You know, it's not just one product. It's many different products, and I don't think there is the capacity for storing all of that. So I think probably, as Robert says, probably will come some storage, and so be it. But we haven't seen any yet.
Got it. Kim, what do you think about the diesel oversupply, I guess, we keep hearing about? Is this something that's going to correct itself? Is it good or bad for product tankers?
Diesel oversupply, well, I think, first of all, I think we have a little bit of a longer discharges. I don't think any one of us is sitting on storage. That's fine. But my little concern here, which is probably not shared totally, but it doesn't matter, I think we have high land storage inventories at the moment. They're pretty full up or filled up. And if this oversupply is going to continue, you know, we're shipping a lot of crude. The crude has to be refined. The refined is going out in consumption or in storage. And according to all the statistics, it's pretty high storage as we speak. So if this continues, I think there is a chance for storage on ships also in the product tanker space, which is a little bit unusual. I totally agree with that. What grades that will be, I no real idea, but surely diesel could be one. And that's a short-term thing. That I see that there is a potential for storage coming up here due to the fact that we have high land storage. And that is temporarily good, and when they're going to unload them, it's going to be temporarily bad, so to speak. But I also think there is a potential for on the long-term side. I think Africa is potentially a continent where there is limited land storage, where there could be a new structured thing, so to speak, to bring products there. And it is being, you know, lots of products are being brought into to Africa these days. And if that continues, I think we'll it's likely that we'll see bigger slugs with products going in there, and some ships being actually sitting there for storage. Could be a longer term thing actually, which is again good for the market.
And that's why I agree with Kim on that, and that's what I meant about we have that to come.
Right. Fair enough. So maybe just switching gears again towards vessels and vessel values and maybe purchases in the secondhand market. Marco, let's start with you on this. What secondhand vessels are attractive to you right now, in age and type? And do you see a disconnect between asset values and rates? Kind of the same thing we're seeing in the crude tanker space, and what do you think it takes to ultimately correct at this location, if you believe it exists?
Well, I think that personally, we have not been players in the second-hand market, so you know it's difficult for me. I think there is some values. What we've been doing is mainly being renewal of the fleet, so mainly we've been going for new buildings. On the other hand, I think there is a value also on second-hand ships. But I think that one thing that probably has been slowing down the second-hand market has been a little bit the lack of financing available for typical purchases of second-hand tonnage. That's been a little bit putting a cap on the second-hand market. Personally, I think that there is some value in second-hand ships. For us, we're in this process of renewal, so it's not something that we've been interested in. But there is certainly some values, and I think that in the future there should be a little bit of catching up of values of second-hand ships. But this is very much finance-driven for the owners of second-hand ships. So I think mainly this is a little bit what I believe is happening in the market. But there is a lot of potential for going up for second-hand ships.
Robert Kim.
Did you say Robert or Kim?
Yeah, either one.
Okay.
Jump on.
Okay, good. We're not in the market either right now, but I think a flexible Eco MR is a good buy now. I think everything is on the secondhand market is a little bit undervalued, but I prefer to mention a type ship that we would invest in. Because we need it or want it, you know, we have systems for it, we have COAs for it, and we can fill that gap by buying that. And I think it's a good value. A five-year-old is 28, and that is a disconnect. And the TC market is 18. That would, you know, theoretically push that price to 35, and that disconnect is there. So if we were to go for anything like now, it would be, you know, on the second-hand side would be a flexible Eco MR.
Robert, you made some second-hand purchases right out of the yard. Is that still the most attractive option for you? Or?
No, I even well, I said agree. Anything the last, I mean, not necessarily. It could be a resale. Could be anything up to, let's say, 2-3 years old.
Okay.
I agree with Kim. Is that you've got to have something that's eco. It's the same as what Marco is saying, that there's an increasing financing spread between, you know, the newer vessels that are 2 or 3 years old and vessels that are 5 and later, because you know the lenders understand the residual risk in product tankers as they start to age and they're not the eco ships. So we have and would only look at those vessels that are 2-3 years old from the high quality yards. I think, though, that the price difference can, in the non-eco vessels, the vessels that are 7-8 years old, you can have this you know, disconnect between earnings, spot earnings, and vessel values going on for some time, because a lot of the owners of the, you know, people like the three of us are saying, you know, we're not buyers of those ships. And many of the big companies that own those ships are trying to come public or securitize their positions. There's no natural buyer or consolidator for those ships that are 7-8 years old. And there is a, you know, ticking time bomb related to operating costs and ability to work in strong, good type of seaways or tradeways, as Kim put it, once they're 15 years old. And then you put on top of that that the equity markets are pretty closed right now. As Marco says, the lending environment is quieter. So I'm not that optimistic about values of you know, five and older product tankers at the moment. And certainly
that's interesting. So let's pick up on that last point.
Cash flow game. I think this is a cash flow game, right, for the time being.
Okay. So then, what would be the game plan going forward? You know, at what point does the product market get, you know, really frothy and suddenly start thinking, do I just sell my assets? Do I sell my vessels? Does it never really get to that point? How do you make product tanker shipping truly investable through this cycle? Like you said, if there's no natural buyer or consolidator at that stage.
Well, I said there's no natural buyer or consolidator for the 5 to 8 year the older vessels.
Right.
You have a lot of companies trying to come public, whether it's TORM or, you know, you can just go on and on here, you know, on and on. So much of the PE money was put into the older vessels, and they're looking to come out and securitize. So you have natural sellers at the moment that are that, as opposed to patient buyers. I mean, if you listen to Kim's language, he's not in a rush to just go out and buy anything.
Kim and Marco, I mean, is there a price that you'd be looking for to sell your assets, or is that never really the game for you? You always sort of just renewing the fleet and kind of going through it.
For us, look, at the end of the game, the day that the game, you have two exits. One exit is selling the tonnage when you feel you're getting to the top. The other exit is to time charter tonnage. Historically, we have been running a big TC book. Our policy is to go, we'll keep it between 40% and 60%. And I think, like we did in the previous cycles, probably when we start feeling that the market is getting too frothy and topping up, we'll probably see an increase of our time charter fleet. And that's how we're going to secure the earnings for the next down cycle. You know, so at the end of the day, these are the only two way outs you have. You have either the sale or the time charter. Luckily, we have a big book of time charters available. We have a good relationship with all the major charters in the world, and probably we go out securing contracts 3 to 5 years, and that should carry us out of the next down cycle. But anyhow, we would be more time charters than sellers.
But Spiros, right now, it's not. This isn't the time to sell. We're not considering. You know, we're seeing that we've just all got lucky. We had a secular change in terms of where product refiners were being placed and trade, and now we just got lucky with the price of oil that's giving us a real cyclical catalyst, and the product market is functioning with the world economy not actually, you know, in great shape. So, you know, you're potentially, you know, years away from the thought of, you know, creating a top. You're certainly not in a blow-off top environment. It's not necessarily us who are looking to sell or exit right now. You just have other capital providers in other companies who are looking to get liquidity or looking to exit.
Yeah, certainly. And I definitely...
Not because of market reasons, just because that's just the way they invest. They buy a company and they look to take it public or they look to sell it.
Right. No, and I wasn't suggesting this was the top. I was just sort of wondering what the game plan was when that arrives, and I agree it's probably years away at this point. Kim, sorry, I think you were about to say something.
I agree. It's you know, the disconnect that is now, it's if anything, a buy signal. It's definitely not a sell signal, and you know, there is upside potential. I realize the pressure from up, from the odd, from the funding and all that, but basically, I think there is a buy, you know, signal out there now with that disconnect and with the future prospects. And would we sell? No, because not. Obviously not, since we're buying. We'd rather buy in such a case. And generally speaking, yeah, we would like to charter out as well over the cycle. And I think we've got, you know, another year or so to find that charter. But the, you know, it's cyclical. It's certainly volatile. This industry. So there will come other cycles too. And that's the time you really should be having the time charter securement. Secure charters as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, okay. We're not precious. I mean, this management has a record that, you know, look, if someone comes in, we're a public company. Anybody comes in and offers a you know, cash premium to where something's trading, well, you've got to properly consider that, regardless of where you think the cycle is. If that cash premium is wholly or partly discounting your future position.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, that's part of the game. I mean, I guess we're generalizing right here now what sentiment we are in right now, what trend, but always that, you know, this a good offer is a good offer. This is you know, tangible assets that could be bought or sold at any time.
Okay. And you mentioned capital markets sort of being locked up. What advice would you give to a company, a tanker company, looking to go public right now? Is it something that you'd all welcome, or how do you feel about that? Marco, start with you.
I think it's not a matter of welcoming or not welcoming. I think the environment is not there. I think today it's pretty difficult to get a new listing of a tanker company. Also because I think the people are not very, I think investors are not very sure about the environment in general. I think so. I don't see it happening very much for new listings. However, I think this can change very quickly. These kind of windows open very very quickly. So I think if somebody is in that position, I would suggest to be a company with a modern fleet, with the assets built in the right shipyards, if these two with a good presence on the market. I think if you have these three conditions, I think probably this is the starting point of a new listing. But I would really emphasize the point of the young fleet, the good yards, and the presence in the market. You know, so somebody who can sell some added value to investors. This is the main thing.
I would say that I think that it would be much better for many of these people to first look to consolidate amongst themselves so that they've got something meaningful when they're coming to the market. Secondly, so here they should not be worrying about filing their S-1s or whatever. What they should be doing is sitting down with each other. Many of them are co-owners in different companies. And they should consolidate first amongst each other, so then they're coming with something of real value and commitment and discipline to the market. Because it's a very weak story when you say, hey, I'm coming with this sort of mid-age fleet and, you know, I'm really doing it just to get liquidity, and now I've got a massive amount of overhang of stock to sell, because the sponsors are going to want to sell over time. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I would have a very clear story that's about yourself. I wouldn't try and comp against other companies. And thirdly, I would set up a structure that, you know, in terms of its governance and representation, is truly representing all of the shareholders, not just the original sponsors. That's what I would do. But most of all, I would forget about going public right now. I would try and consolidate amongst each other.
Okay. That's interesting. Kim, you agree with that sentiment?
Yep, I do. we're not all that active in the capital markets, and I understand it's partly saturated as it is. We have no problems in raising money, you know, through normal bank system on the lending side. Banks, you know, go by relationship and experience and quality and all the rest of it. Haven't really thought of whether I'm more or less happy if Hafnia is private or public, really. If they're public, I know what they're doing, at least. So maybe that's one notch better.
Fair enough. Okay, great. So let's move to the Q&A session here to make sure we get these in. And I'm just going to look at some of the questions now and screen them for any profanity. And it looks like they're all pretty PG. It looks like you've answered a few of them already. So let's go to one here. So it looks like there's interest in removing the oil export ban in the U.S., and potentially that could mean more crude exports and less product exports. Is that the right way to read this, and how do you see this impacting the product tanker market? Any of you care to jump on that?
Well, I think this is Marco. I think that the crude ban, removing the crude ban, certainly would be very beneficial for crude tankers. There would be increase in movements of crude to the United States, everywhere. That would be because at a certain point you would start trading all this crude. Probably the United States will be exporting a lot of crude, probably refining less. But then I think it's also a mix of the refineries. Probably the refineries would be importing crude from other parts in the world in order to find the right crude that matches up to the refining capacity. So I think at the end of the day, would be kind of a wash, I think. Certainly would be beneficial for crude tankers. For products, it would be kind of a wash. I think the strong market where we are today would continue. Because I think at the end of the whole story, what counts is imbalances. The more you create imbalances, the more you create trade. The fact that you have products moving left, right, and center, that's good for the industry. So, and as long as there is trading, I think that's good for us. So I think probably a removal of the ban on crude probably would be increasing, opening new routes, opening new refineries have to move their products. So I think would not be changing. I think there are other aspects also in this equation that that have to be considered. I think probably what kind of products move from where to where. And I think this of the crude ban out of the United States for sure will not be very good for U.S. refineries, but then everything will rebalance.
Kim, Robert, anything to add there?
No, I agree with Marco. Oil on the water is always good, extra oil, that is. It's in the future, and I think it will have limited effect. You know, one thing, though, is the refineries, U.S. refineries, are pretty competitive as it is, and they're good at selling products. And I think there is still a kind of focus on doing that, to continue to sell to Latin America and South America and Africa and so on. So I think maybe it won't be any big movements in any event. I think they will continue to focus on making products out of it.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the next question here. So what are you hearing from the shipyards in terms of their financial stability and maybe open slots? Do you think this will create a price war that ultimately drives oversupply or new ordering if in one or more of the shipping sectors? Anyone care to take that one?
I would like to make a comment. I think the last thing that shipyards need and they can afford to have now is a pricing war. I think they have so many problems, yards, especially in Korea, that are the big builders of product tankers. They have huge problems in all the offshore sector. I think the last thing that they can afford now to do is underpricing. I think this has been very detrimental for them. It's been very detrimental also for the order book. Orders that have been passed in 2012-13 just below market that made them lose a lot of money, and I don't think they're willing to do it now. I think now probably they're pricing themselves very, very, very accurately.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the next one, the Volkswagen scandal. So looks like right now, as we said before, there's a lot of middle distillate out there. I suppose this scandal has the ability to reduce diesel demand in Europe. Are you hearing anything on the ground or in your space that maybe could see an impact on product tankers as it relates to diesel demand in Europe?
I can certainly not. This is Kim. I think actually we'll blow over one way or another, and I haven't thought about any potential impact going forward. Again, potentially short term, some extra storage, some extra need for ships to store it potentially, but in the long run, no.
Yeah.
Oh, I think
Robert.
That...
Robert or Marco?
Robert.
Either one. It's fine. I mean, look, for me, this is a bit like Kim is saying. It's like, okay, there's a lot of things, and what if this, and, you know, it's like lots of sort of drama, but first, we don't really know. Second, whatever, it's going to, you know, take a long time, whether it ends up being a positive or a negative. And, you know, everyone's just playing a bunch of what-ifs right now. And I think that the market is particularly sensitive to that. You know, it's the same as when, you know, Glencore, the one day is down, you know, 50, next day is up 30. It's, you know, you sort of had this sort of end of the world. I mean, the amount of emails I was getting for 2 days on, you know, the end of the world for the products market as if, so these things just need time, just to, as Kim say, blow over so you can, you know, work out if there's going to be any effects at all either way.
The only thing that I can see out of all of this is that probably diesel consumption is going to be decreasing in the world, and especially the big diesel market has always been Europe. And Europe has always been creating this arbitrage of exporting gasoline to the United States and importing diesel. Now, if there is more need for gasoline in Europe, I think that at the end of the day, they'll probably need to import gasoline from somewhere else. So probably could turn into something very beneficial because, you know, and I think as both of Kim and Robert said, this it's very premature to make some conclusions, but for sure there's going to be an oversupply of diesel because I think we're starting to see a little bit the writing on the wall that diesel people are focusing on consuming less diesel, and normally the future will be more on the gasoline than not on the diesel.
Right now, I think it's much more interesting that actually for the first time in our careers, we're doing some trade to China and out of China in products. It's also, you know, more interesting that, you know, we're ramping up trade to Australia and New Zealand because of environmental changes, or as Kim alluded to earlier, that West Africa, as it develops, is, you know, completely short of refinery capacity. That South America is continuing going forward, and then the ancillary trades such as, you know, vegetable oils and palm oils keep growing and keep adding, you know, not just straightforward raw demand, but really good triangulation possibilities and differentials in the market. So I think it's very, and I think that's part of the reason this diversity of the market throughout the world is part of the reason why we're seeing this seasonal strength that we're seeing at the moment in the market.
Okay.
So the what if at the moment, or the what if worries of U.S. exports or whatever. I mean, you know, something like palm oil, which is hardly ever written about, the growth is phenomenal worldwide in that consumption at the moment.
Okay.
These are long voyages.
Yeah, certainly. Go ahead.
Daniel, if you start talking about the veg oils, you have to consider also China regulations, things that bring oils for human consumption have to be dedicated ships. That's going to create furthermore a segregation, so there's going to be more ships going into niches, and that's going to be good for the general trading pattern.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think here that, you know, for all the top, of course, the U.S. Gulf is an important market, but, I mean, on a good week, you have 33 or 34 MR fixtures. And if that is, you know, if the average voyage, because a lot of them are short voyages with the Caribbean, is 21 days, then, you know, that's 90 vessels out of a present fleet of 1,200 to 1,400.
Okay.
So the market in products, what's great about it is, unlike, let's say, the Capesize bulk market or the VLCC market, it is so diverse. It's looking at a shareholder list that isn't the equivalent in stock market of looking at a company that doesn't have sort of, instead of having three top holders that own 25%, the product market has a lot of quality shareholders of, you know, somewhere between 3%, 4%, and 7% and 8% in all its different regions.
And, you know, if you also, if you measure it against the Cape, how many cargoes can a Cape carry? You know, it's kind of limited. Product tankers can carry hundreds of different types of cargo. So I think the market is much more open to shifting patterns, shifting needs, and production shifts. So, you know, I think there is always more activity. And the more activity there is, the better it is for product tankers. The more unbalances there are, the better it is for us. So I think,
I do think it's interesting that in general there are way more questions on, oh my gosh, what does U.S. export ban lift mean, or oh my gosh, Volkswagen, ever than asking us questions on vegetable oil trades or palm oil trades or regulations.
We'll talk to our friends at the Wall Street Journal about that then. See if we can get some visual headlines. Okay. No, those are all very good points. So maybe see if we can get one more in here. And you mentioned China. It looks like this one has to do with China. What role do you see China playing in the product tanker market going forward? There's been some refining project delays that have come up recently, and we're also seeing a lot of headlines with respect to a slowing down economy. Does this impact the product trade at all?
Well, China's never been much part of the product trade. So really anything that's going on in China is a net positive. It's a marginal addition. So we're not feeling the slowing of the economy. It's sort of the reverse. It's, you know, whether or not they're taking in, you know, more vegetable oils, or whether or not they're taking in more reformates and occasionally gasoline and exporting diesel, these are all plus ton miles.
Yep.
Actually, we're seeing more activity out of China. Something Robert said, right? China's never been a big player, but for sure the activity that's been now due to the slowdown in China, we're noticing that there is more export from China for the unused products that they're having in the domestic market. So the slowdown of China actually is turning into something good for us, because the excess of products they have for the internal market, they have to move it out. So we're starting to see a lot of trips out of China.
Yeah. Kim, similar response?
Similar response. Absolutely similar response. China's always been balanced. What they need, they bring in on VLCCs, basically, and they refine it and they use it. So whatever they can't use now, it's being exported. And I understand there is a, whatever, 20% increase in gasoline demand, whatever, in China. And so they have to produce a lot of gasoline. And in doing so, they got a lot of extra diesel, and that they don't know what to do about. And they're going to start exporting it. And we're talking about in the neighborhood of 1 million tons. I mean, people are talking about that could be the export volumes out of China in the near future. And
okay.
That's quite a bit, and it adds up to whatever else we see. So, of course, there were steel markets from Korea and India, whatever, but they're going to ship it long, and they're going to probably ship it to Africa or Australia, and they're welcome.
Everybody has to rebalance to different markets, and that means probably further away markets, and that means more ton mile, which is going to be beneficial for us.
I mean, Spiro, I think what excites the three of us in the products, and, you know, because, you know, we've been doing it for quite a while, is that sort of the first time in our careers, you know, we've got a really dynamic, diverse market in terms of types of cargoes and different places we're sending it, and that's really exciting. At the same time, you know, it's very difficult for us to be able to, you know, properly explain this.
Okay. Robert is right, and I think what also has been very exciting is that the fact, you know, for many years we've been preaching about the Middle Eastern refineries coming in and displacing other refineries, and then finally it has happened. So for many years we were talking about that, and then all of a sudden it happened. So, you know, sometimes it's nice to see that what you've been talking about, it really happens after a while.
Sure, sure. Okay, and it looks like we got time for one more, so we're just going to sneak it in, and this one's actually addressed to Robert, but it looks like any of you can really chime in and speak to it. So it says, Mr. Bugby, in the past you said that a floating dividend policy is not how you secure long-term shareholder capital. The best way to secure shareholder capital is to sell the company. When you consider a fleet of 80 or more vessels, isn't there a limited audience that can digest such a large acquisition?
Of course there is.
Okay.
Translate the question for me, please.
So, yeah, let's see. Okay, so floating dividend policy is not the way to go. I guess first part there is, do you agree or disagree? It sounds like he's quoting you on that one. And is the best way to secure shareholder capital to sell the company? And I guess the last point or the question is...
Okay. There is no question. No question.
No question.
I've been very lucky in my career that... You know, being able to be part of building three companies and selling three companies, there is no question that selling a company is the best way to securitize gain and value for the total shareholder group. That's a given.
Okay.
The floating dividend policy, I think for... You know, I think that, you know, you do have to, you know, we really want to focus until you've sold a company. You've really got to, you are owning it until you can sell it. You don't know whenever you can. And therefore, you know, dividends to us should be regular. They should be sort of as proper dividends. And you should work it from the bottom up. In other words, you should be prepared to pay that dividend in a bad market as well as a good market. And, you know, we want to, we're not really that interested in trying to bring in shareholders who, you know, are attracted by a headline of, oh my gosh, this quarter the dividend is going to be equivalent to 9-10%, especially in an industry that is both cyclical and seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we will continue making a regular dividend. I can understand why some companies pay a dividend that way, and I can understand why investment bankers encourage it, because you almost destine the industry to always have to raise capital if it's paying out all its capital a long way.
Okay. Yep. Marco or Kim,
we're not afraid to return capital in excess as well. I mean, there are times when the stock is trading, you know, where we think it's appropriate to buy the stock, and we have done that. And
sure,
we would leave ourselves open if we had, you know, surplus to those long-term positions. We would leave ourselves open always to, you know, to pay a special dividend. But your dividend itself, we really strongly believe, should be, you know, an old-fashioned regular dividend.
Okay. Marco or Kim, do you agree?
Nothing really more to add there. I agree with that sentiment. We have a similar policy of irregular dividend payments. I'm happy to finish my part on that note.
No, I would tend to agree with Robert, especially because when he said a cyclical and seasonal industry, let's not also forget it's a very capital-intensive industry. So I think if you have at heart the long-term interest of the company of growing it and keeping it a major player, and like Robert says in his case, until it's sold, I have to run it like my own company. I think also that has repercussions on dividends. I think in good years you should distribute better dividends, and in very bad years, probably there a little bit disagree with Robert, in bad years you shouldn't distribute too much dividends. However, I think it's not a sprint, it's a marathon shipping. So I think you should go over all the cycles and look at the long-term return.
Okay. That's great. Well, we've taken up plenty of your time. We thank everyone for calling in. Thank you for all your questions or signing in. Thank you for all your questions. Nicholas, I think it's time to hand it back to you.
Thank you very much, Spiro. Thank you very much, Kim, Marco, and Robert. I think it has been a tremendous webinar. Great discussion, very timely. And I would like to mention two things. First of all, that the webcast will be available as an audio archive in a couple of hours from now, so anyone who would like to access it on demand, you're welcome to come back at www.capitallinkwebinars.com. And the second thing is there will be a transcript available in a day or so from now, and anyone interested can request a transcript at no cost. Again, the idea is we'd like to put out information about the industry, and anyone who's interested, you can request a transcript at transcripts@capitallink.com. And with that, thank you very much to everybody, and we look forward to the next webinar. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Disconnect.